quotes, infused with the scent of potpourri, a film to commit to memory. Crossing the felt ropes, watching from home on my TV, looking at all my eyes can see, they tell me I view obsessively.
Hello and welcome to The Obsessive Viewer. We're a weekly podcast that reviews one or two new release titles every episode with an occasional free-for-all segment at the end that we call Potpourri. You can find more of our work, including my written reviews, full episode show notes, and the complete backlog of our episodes at obsessiveviewer.com. You can also write into the show by emailing me at matt@obsessiveviewer.com. And if you'd like to support us and get access to hundreds of exclusive episodes, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. Where you can get access to content at any of our tier levels on a recurring monthly subscription basis, or you can buy individual collections a la carte in the Patreon shop section. Recently on Patreon, I haven't had that much stuff out there recently. I've been talking about how I'm about to start Bly Manor for Flanagan Fridays, and I promise that's happening. And then I need to get back into Foundation for Sci-Fi Saturdays. And yeah, there's just a bunch of stuff that's been going on with me outside of podcasting, so I haven't been able to do much in terms of Patreon, but I do still have that immediate reaction to The First Omen up there, and plus years and years worth of content in hundreds of episodes. So once again, you can sign up at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer for all of that and a bunch more content. I'm your host, Matt Hurt, and you can find me on social media, which includes Letterboxd at obsessiveviewer. And in our feature review this week, Mike and I will be reviewing the new Radio Silence horror film Abigail, which opened in theaters last week on April 19th. Then later in the show, I'll be sharing my thoughts on the new movie Sasquatch Sunset, which is also currently in theaters, and I'll be doing that in a non-spoiler secondary review. But before we get to all of that, and before we bring Mike onto the show, I do have some entertainment news items and general housekeeping to do. So I'm doing all of this before I get on the call with Mike to review Abigail. So news before the reviews. I don't have much in terms of entertainment news, but more immediate news for actually local people here. So first, before I get into all of that, this episode is dropping this Thursday on April 25th. And tomorrow, if you're listening to this day of, so on April 26th, I will have a piece on Midwest Film Journal, an essay about James Mangold's 310 to Yuma. That's going to be published on Midwest Film Journal as part of their month-long tribute to Russell Crowe that they're calling A Murder of Crows. So my essay will be up there tomorrow if you're listening to this day of. I highly encourage you to read the essay. I'm proud of it. 310 to Yuma is one of my favorite like westerns. It's just so well done. It's so great. And I'm really proud of that essay. So go check that out, and also check out the rest of the writing for A Murder of Crows, because they are killing it, no pun intended, over at Midwest Film Journal for this particular, and all of their essay series, obviously. The couple of other more local news items I want to bring up is that a friend of the show and my friend Nick, he messaged me today, and it was a link to a Can-Can screening. So the Can-Can Theater is a local theater here in Indianapolis. It's kind of it's kind of an independent like specialty theater. It's where I saw Seven Samurai a couple years ago, and I also saw The Conversation there. It's a really cool, like, theater / bistro kind of restaurant, combination. It's really cool. They are showing on May 15th, they're showing Dersu Uzala, that's being presented by the IUPUI Arts and Humanities Institute on May 15th. Dersu Uzala is a Kurosawa movie that I have not seen. So I am, now that I'm actually saying that out loud, I need to buy my ticket. So I'm going to buy a ticket and I'm going to go see it because I love Akira Kurosawa's work and I have not seen Dersu Uzala. So just a heads up that is going to be at the Can-Can Theater on May 15th and I will be there. So check it out. I'll put a link in the show notes. And then finally, the last piece of news that I have before we get into the episode proper is just to highlight the PopCon Indy 2024. So if you guys heard last week, my friend Brandon Peters was on the show, and we talked a bit about PopCon and the live podcast stage. And so in the interim between that episode and this recording, Brandon has posted the full schedule of the podcast stage. So he wrote, I'm just going to read the blurb from the Brandon Peters show Facebook page. It says, the 2024 PopCon Indy live podcast stage schedule is all set with a killer lineup to see each day. Make it a part of your day to stop by and take in a live podcast recording. The stage is located between the championship darts exhibit and cosplay alley, which are near the celebrity photo ops, consult your maps and schedules for additional info. And he posted the full schedule, and like, it's heavy hitter after each one. It's really cool. So a few highlights. He's got like he's going to be present for a lot of them, I believe. But they're doing a kickoff show Friday, April 26th at 2 p.m. A kickoff show with him, and they also got the Normies on there. They're a YouTube channel that I haven't watched, but I heard one of the Normies on the Brandon Peters show, and I really enjoyed his insight into movies and stuff. So I'm going to check out their YouTube. And then The Established Facts is there Friday as well. The Established Facts is a podcast that I mingled with when we would do PopCon, and they're really friendly guys. They're really nice people. And then Saturday there's the Brandon Peters show live. Brandon is also doing a live thing for titled For the Love of Godzilla with Jeff Arbuckle from Film Seizure podcast, which I just started listening to and I really enjoy. And then Sunday, Chris Spangle live. Chris Spangle is a friend of the show. The first ever episode of The Obsessive Viewer was recorded on Chris Spangle's equipment. I think the second episode was too. I'm not sure, but, so he's going to be on the podcast stage on Sunday. And then there's going to be at 3 p.m. Poorly Described Movies, The Game with Brandon Peters and Chris Johnson. So that's just a few highlights. That's a few highlights of the podcaster stage. If you're going to be at PopCon, I highly recommend going over there, checking out some podcasts, interacting with it. If it is an interactive show that's going, I should make that clear. And just check it out because there's a lot of really good, like, local indie podcasts here in Indianapolis that you know, if you have time, just check it out, see what they're all about. I am obviously not going to be on the podcast stage this year. I haven't really done anything with PopCon in the past few years, but I think I might try to get some time on the podcast stage next year, because I it's been so long since I've done anything like that, and I haven't been to PopCon in several years, and I kind of really want to see just how it's grown, how it's changed, how like the podcast stage in general has evolved. So I definitely I'm going to hopefully maybe do that. I'll put a feeler out for like sometime later in the year, and see what I can get done. But anyway, that is all I have before I get into the featured review with Mike. Just once again, check out PopCon Indy if you're in Indianapolis, and also check out the Brandon Peters show. I was very happy with my chat with Brandon last week, and I highly recommend his show, because there's something I didn't really talk about in the episode, was that two things. One, I've known him through the local podcaster scene here, and like, he's just a very hard worker. He's just very diligent. He's a presence in the local podcaster scene. So I have a lot of respect for Brandon, and I'm very grateful that he took the time to chat with me about Civil War last week. And then also something I didn't mention, and if I get him back on the show at some point, I do want to mention something to give you an idea about the Brandon Peters show, is that he ends each show with saying "Stay film positive," which that's something I meant to talk to him about in the episode, but we ran out of time. But that's just something that's just really stuck with me ever since I really started listening to his show. Just stay film positive. I just really like that as an addendum to, as a closing line of his show. It's just, it's a really good, marker for the show. So anyway, check that out. Brandon Peters Show. That's all I've got for news and items before, the review. So let's go ahead and bring it on. Let's get into our main, episode. Joining me this week for this week's feature review is one of the OG co-hosts of The Obsessive Viewer and one piece of the two-man band who created the theme song for this podcast, As Good As It Gets. Welcome back to the show, Mike White. How is
That's
it going,
me.
Buddy? Yes.
It's going well.
Nice.
Hey, buddy.
Nice. How you been? We can kind of do the like preamble thing here.
Yeah, good. Watching movies. You know, what's funny, so the movie that we're about to review, Abigail, kind of quietly just so happened to be the 600th movie at movie night.
Oh, nice.
The other night, this week, yeah. And very little fanfare. Like, we barely even remembered that it was.
That
and just kind of moved on.
That's so interesting because for new listeners and old listeners alike, Mike and his friend Jake do movie night every Thursday. And so like, let me ask you this. So I know that the plan, I don't know. I know you had plans in place for 500, but that overlapped with the pandemic, I believe.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately we did a 500 and, it was Spider-Man No Way Home and
that's
was
right.
great. Yeah.
Nice.
But we don't do, like I said, we kind of like I knew that 600 was coming up and it just kind of came and went. You get to a certain, once I think you pass 500, that becomes your new like baseline for anniversaries. Like, yeah, we'll get excited when we hit 1,000.
Yep.
Now it's more about, you know, the anniversary. We'll talk in August. We'll go, hey, we've been doing this for 14 years or whatever.
Nice. Yeah. With the podcast, we got 75 more episodes before we get to 500.
That's awesome.
So
yeah. Very cool.
Yep. And since I've been doing weekly episodes, that's going to come a lot quicker than expected. So that's exciting.
Awesome.
Yeah. And, speaking of movie theaters and stuff, something before we get into the review, by the way, we're going to do a feature review, obviously, of Abigail, in a non-spoiler and spoiler review. We are live streaming this. So, join Patreon. Even if you join Patreon as a free member, you can get notified when we go live, with these live streams and everything. And also just subscribe to the YouTube channel. What I've been doing is I've been making video versions of the reviews and posting them. So like this review will be posted next Tuesday, or next Monday. I'm sorry. Next Monday. So the primary or the feature review goes up on Monday. The, secondary review goes up on Wednesday. And then, but yeah, but anyway, to get into our review, I want to talk a little bit about the box office. I don't have the stats in front of me or anything, but, it was neck and neck. Like, we're not like a box office prognostication show or anything like that.
Right. As obsessive as we can be, a box office is not really our thing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we don't really do this or anything, but I found it interesting that Abigail was the new release, big ticket new release. And it's just got number two. Like it was neck and neck with Civil War. Civil War took the top at the box office, the domestic box office, and Abigail was second. And I saw like a headline somewhere. I'll dig it up and put it in the show notes of the episode when this goes up on Thursday. But there was a headline saying that like, is this like horror movie fatigue? Is this because Abigail is the type of horror movie that would absolutely destroy in like April, like pre-summer blockbuster season.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But there has been just such a wealth of high profile, mainstream, big release, horror movies. Is it a fatigue issue or is Civil War just that good and in high demand? What's your take on it, Mike?
I'm formulating it right now, to be honest with you. So, So you did, you know, or is Civil War that much better? I think I think you have to take Civil War out of the equation. Like, I'm less concerned that Abigail was number two than when you talk about there being a horror fatigue. That it looks like 10 million was the weekend for Abigail, 10.3, compared to Civil War's 11 million. And you referenced, you know, a early or a mid spring, kind of a summer kickoff type of horror movie like Abigail usually goes off, like, comparable to what?
I don't know what examples. I don't have any examples. Like, the article just said that it's the type of release, so it didn't. I don't know if it actually had like any examples. It could have just been talking about it.
Okay, interesting. I'd be curious to see, because like I said, or like we said, box office is not generally a thing that we cover.
Right.
So is 10 million a disappointment?
I don't know, because here's the thing, like, with I don't know if we should compare it to like Scream or Scream 6, like, you know, other radio silence
movies.
Which
is easy to do because it's radio silence.
Yeah, but those are franchises.
The production team. Yeah, that doesn't count.
Yeah.
Gosh, I'm trying to think. I should be more prepared.
Well, I kind of just threw this at you.
Yeah, I know. That's an interesting topic, though. Is there a fatigue? You know, everything like that is cyclical. We've been talking about a comic book movie fatigue for 2-3+ years. Is it happening to horror? You know, we have still. You and I, and then my friend Jake, who I do movie night with, we've kind of talked about just how fortunate we are to live in a time where there are so many horror movies. In fact, 7 of my current top 10 movies of the year so far are horror movies, because they're nice. It's just like every week there's a new one coming out. So is there fatigue? Almost certainly, right?
Yeah, I would say probably. Is there mainstream fatigue? Like, for the people like John Q moviegoer who
totally
isn't like seeking out horror,
right?
Because it's interesting.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. I am not fatigued. My friend Jake is not fatigued either. But yeah, is the mainstream audience? I think so. I don't think that they were. You know, my gauge is always. So anybody who doesn't know, I teach high school. I teach sophomores, 15-16-year-olds, and they're kind of a good gauge of what the general audience is at the movies.
Sure.
And they're not interested in Civil War either. Okay, so Evil Dead Rise last year was an April release.
Oh, okay.
And it made $23.5 million at the box office.
Like,
so,
cumulative or opening weekend?
No, opening weekend. Sorry.
Okay. Oh, you're good.
Weekend. Gosh, 10 million. Forgive me here. I am working through these thoughts or this argument.
Well,
I think there's... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say 10 million. It's interesting because it had a B cinema score, which is, according to IndieWire, it's good for like a horror movie. It's surprisingly good for a horror movie.
Yeah.
But it's usually not a great indicator of like reaction, because people who are going to the movie theater and like are the ones who are rating it are like they're going to see that movie specifically. But it's interesting to note that like the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare or Warfare was out this weekend too, and that got, I think, fourth place behind Godzilla X Kong. So kind of interesting.
So this is comparable. Renfield, which came out about a year ago at this time, an April release by Universal Pictures, a vampire movie, it also bombed.
Oh, yeah.
That it was 8 million. So I would hate to, and because I liked Abigail.
Yeah.
people on the internet love to be the first to like declare something dead, you know? So whoever wrote that article is probably excited to be the first one to say, see, I told you, yeah. I told you there's horror fatigue.
The headline in this IndieWire article is literally horror overkill dooms Abigail as Civil War ekes out narrow second weekend.
Right. Come on.
Yeah, I think that is...
Settle down.
Especially when you consider that this is... I mean, this is as subjective as it gets, but, like, this is comparatively... Compared to other horror releases this year, this is higher tier level horror. This is premium
Abigail
horror.
Has a little bit more prestige than something else. And I don't think to the average audiences it does. I think they're lumping it in with other PG-13 fare. I think we come in knowing that it's radio silence, knowing it's a little more elevated, and not to throw my bestest buddy in the whole world under the bus, Jake. If you listen to this, Jake, I love you. Shout out to you. But we disagreed on the trailer of this. He would be like, oh, I'm not looking forward to that. And I'd be like, what? Like, I was surprised. Usually we're pretty lock in step with what we're excited about. And he was like, not excited to see this movie. And I was like, it's radio silence and it looks awesome. I was surprised. Luckily, he liked it. Spoiler alert. I liked it too.
Nice.
But I think, I don't know. I don't know what it was about the trailer. I think that there is also vampire movie fatigue.
Yeah,
I think Renfield and Last Voyage of the Demeter last year, I think that there's a universal monster vampire fatigue thing also going on. That's kind of been going on for a while now.
That makes sense, especially when they can't really get it off the ground. And when they can get it off the ground, it's like with The Invisible Man, which happened during the like beginning of the pandemic, and I'm sure that kind of put the kibosh on a lot of plans.
And finally, I also think a lot of people saw this as trying to capitalize on the popularity of Megan.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I can see that. Yes. Oh my God. I didn't even consider that.
I agree. I don't think it's anything like Megan. Mm-hmm. Respect to anybody who liked that movie, but I thought that movie was garbage. And
you didn't like Megan. M3.
No, I really disliked Megan.
Interesting. Yeah. I thought it was fun. For what it was.
Yeah. Do we agree that this movie's on a different level than Megan?
Oh, whoa, 110%. Okay.
Okay.
All right. We can get into the actual review at that, too.
Let's review Abigail.
Let's do it. And to bring us into this review, of course, we're going to do a non-spoiler and then spoiler review. I'll play a clip from the trailer to transition us over to the spoiler section. Once we do that, you can check the show notes of the episode. The show notes are available at obsessiveviewer.com/OV425. Once this goes live on Thursday, and that's where you can find timestamps and show notes and links and everything. But let's go into the review. The premise, according to IMDb, is after a group of criminals kidnap the ballerina daughter of a powerful underworld figure, they retreat to an isolated mansion, unaware that they're locked inside with no normal little girl. Directors for this movie were Matt Bettinelli-Ulpin and Tyler Gillette, two of the three who make up the collective Radio Silence. Writers were Stephen Shields and Guy Busick, and the cast includes Melissa Barrera, Dan Stevens, Alicia Weir, Will Catlett, Catherine Newton, Kevin Durand, Angus Cloud, and Giancarlo Esposito.
Esposito, yep.
Yes. Which I paused there because I realized for years I don't think I've ever said his name out loud, and I've always pronounced it in my brain Giancarlo, but it's Giancarlo. I looked it up. So in non-spoiler terms, Michael, what did you think of Abigail, and how does it stack up with the rest of Radio Silence's filmography?
Oh, that's difficult to do because I'm going to maybe unfairly remove Scream from that conversation.
Sure.
Scream comes with so much other baggage that they're... I mean, by all means, their fingerprints are all over that movie and all, two movies. And you and I both are on record that we loved those movies.
Oh, yeah.
But I think our love for them has more to do with our love for Scream.
Yes.
Than it does as good as their contribution. So the comparison is Ready or Not, right?
Oh, yeah. Which this has a lot of that Ready or Not DNA in
very
in
much so. In fact, it's kind of a cool inverted version of Ready or Not, whereas in Ready or Not, it was one survivor, Samara Weaving, the bride, against many, kind of closing in on her. Whereas in this one, it was many, where the one, the girl, in this case as well, is kind of attacking them. I don't know how intentional that inversion is, but to compare the two is pretty fun. You know, locked in a dusty old mansion. I thought that was cool. Going into the movie, how much better, or when they were conceiving of the movie and making the movie and before the trailer was cut, how much of it do you think Abigail being a vampire was supposed to be a surprise to us as well? And that's not a spoiler, because that's just the trailer. That's just the plot of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Abigail is a vampire.
Yes.
It's in the
poster. A ballerina vampire.
So there's a good 20 minutes of the movie where part of the suspense is like, what's going on? And we're all like, it's her.
I want to say it's maybe like 45 minutes maybe like 35 to 40 minutes.
I was being generous, but it's no less than 30.
Yeah. It was to the point where I was wondering that myself, like how much it, like would it have been effective or would it have been gimmicky? To have like it concealed in the trailer, and be something that would be just revealed in the theater, like when we see it.
You can show them being attacked, right? Yeah. You can show killings and moments and
like build a mystery around what is happening, which is what the movie does in the first act, really.
It does.
But I don't know. I'm so glad. Surprisingly so. I'm glad that it didn't go that route. It wasn't that, because I feel like if it had been marketed that way as a mystery, I would have been in like slasher movie mode. I would have been in like a whodunit mode or what's going on mode. And knowing that it's building toward a vampire plot, and knowing that while the movie is played so straight, it's played so straight and so earnestly with its like caper plot.
Right.
Like I could just really get into it. And that also heightened a lot of the comedy surrounding like the characters being like, the line from the trailer, like we kidnapped a vampire, a ballerina vampire. Like, it's ridiculous in the way that they respond. It's really effective.
You don't get that a lot in movies, I think, where, you know, it's kind of a Scream-esque kind of thing that they realize like the genre of movie that they're in, right? Like, how would a person act if they saw a vampire? Are you kidding me? I kind of like their reaction.
Me too.
So for me, there's kind of two things really to talk about, or at least that kind of like highlight my experience. There's the ensemble, and we can talk about that first. And then there's how, if you're going into a vampire movie, how does it play with the lore, and how does it play by the rules? I'm super interested in that. We might tiptoe a little bit because we'll talk a little bit more in spoilers, but let's talk a little bit about the ensemble. What were some of your favorite performances and moments of the cast?
Oh my God. Okay. So the cast over this ensemble is fantastic.
I agree.
I love them. Melissa Barrera, I think she's a phenomenal like lead for the ensemble in this movie. Dan Stevens,
all of the criticism against her in Scream 1, I think she's put that to bed.
Oh, 100%. I kind of completely forgot that there was a lot of criticism about her in Scream 1. Like that's a good point. I think she, between like, And I feel like I understand some of those criticisms from Scream, but like between Scream and then Scream 6 and then now this, like she's grown a lot. Like it's been it's been a really great run for her for these three movies. And I'm excited to see what she does next. If she stays in like this final girl level, like thing, or what have you, but I'm excited to see her in more things. And I'm aware that she's been in other things other than Radio Silence movies, obviously, but I do want to mention freaking Dan Stevens, man. Like,
yeah, he's excellent. He's excellent.
Yeah. He's him this year, like between this and Godzilla X Kong, like he's having such a field day with these roles. Like he is playing like these heightened, like weird, sleazy people in some cases. But like in here, I saw a headline. I didn't really read too much into it, but they talked about how his, like his makeup design and his hair styling and everything was patterned or inspired by an I Think You Should Leave sketch, which, have you watched I Think You Should Leave?
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God.
It's, I love I Think You Should Leave.
Oh, my God. I'm so glad that you said that because I didn't want to go into hardcore pitch mode because...
No, I love, love, love.
It's one of my favorite comedy anythings, man.
One of the few rare shows that I've watched.
Oh, my God. Yeah. It's... Oh, my God. It's so good. And as an aside... I am like heartbroken that because they went on like a tour with I Think You Should Leave, and I'm heartbroken that they didn't come to Indy because I would have 100% gone. But but anyway, they patterned his look after, apparently it's after the sloppy steak. No, yeah, the sloppy steaks sketch, the slick back hair, like just looking like a douchebag.
Awesome.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
I was sloppy a piece steak. Of shit though.
Yeah. That's so great.
But not anymore. I said was.
I was.
Yeah. Oh my God.
I watch by the way, listeners and viewers, welcome to the I Think You Should Leave podcast.
Oh,
we're
my
excited for you to be here.
Yes.
But no, I kind of quote very often, maybe too often. I don't really want to be around anymore.
Yes. Oh my God. When that season aired, and then season 2 was posted, I was at work. And I was in the office at work, and like that day, like I went to, like, not to be crass, but I went to the bathroom, and while I was in the bathroom, I was like, I could watch the first couple of sketches on my phone. And the that one is like the second sketch of the season, and it was like to be a fly on that wall in the bathroom. Like I was holding, like I was in tears laughing because it's brilliant.
Awesome.
It's absolutely brilliant. But anyway, all that's to say, Dan Stevens is great in this.
He's great. Kevin Durand is consummate that guy, right?
Oh my God. Yeah.
Who's that? What's he in? To me, he's like the MVP of the movie. He's kind of doing a bit of like a oh my gosh, his name is escaping me, Drax from Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, I totally
so
get
much,
that.
And I love him. Why can't
oh my God. Oh my God.
This is horrible.
Dave Bautista. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
He is kind of doing a Bautista thing. And like as a lovable Hulkish type of figure.
Kind of a gentle giant. Somewhat kind of against type, sort of.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And I love him in that. Do you ever, how do you feel about like heavy exposition scenes? Jake and I, when we're watching movies, we kind of have this joke where when they're like dropping exposition. It's one of those things where it's kind of like you wish you never noticed it in the first place.
Yes.
'Cause now you notice it every time it's in a movie. But there's the scene, if you don't know what I'm talking about, listeners, they're standing around the pool table, and they do this gimmick where Melissa Barrera's character, named Joey, they're all named after the Rat Pack, can predict where they're all really from and their characteristics. And it was one moment of the movie where I felt Radio Silence was being a little formulaic.
You know, it's interesting. I didn't find it too formulaic. I do find it interesting that in the last 2 weeks, like that's something in terms of screenwriting that I praised to no end in Civil War. Have you seen Civil War yet?
I haven't yet.
No. Okay. It's my God. It's really good. But anyway, the way that the exposition is delivered in that movie is very organic and very just like it's lived in. It's like it's lived in that setting. Here, I didn't mind it too much because it is very much a checklist scene. It is a scene where it's like, okay, well,
yeah,
let's like it. It could have been done worse. I will say that. And I didn't mind the way it was done. Yeah. When we go into spoilers, I'll kind of expand on how it could have been done so much worse. But I do think that it's a pretty organic way to do it in a structured screenplay sort of cage, basically.
Yeah.
So I didn't mind it. To go back to Kevin Durand real quick, just to give a quick shout out to him. Like, yes, he is a that guy actor, but the thing that I know him from the most that I have just, this won't surprise you that I'm going to speak highly of him in this, but it's his appearance on Lost in, I think, season 4. My God, like he plays that like kind of sociopathic, like heavy guy. Like hitman, kind of contract killer, military guy. So what I really appreciate about his performance here is that he is obviously built that way and he is showcased that way. He's introduced that way, but there's just such a lovable chemistry between him and Catherine Newton. Like this friendship that forms between them is just so like sweet. And it's kind of nice. Which also Catherine Newton, talking about horror comedy, even like Lisa Frankenstein and this, like she's been in tons of stuff. I really love this ensemble, man.
Yeah, it's great.
And
then so opposite the ensemble is Alicia Weir as the titular Abigail, who kind of has two things to do in the movie. For the first 30-ish minutes, she's just kind of this young, innocent, kidnapped little girl.
Yep. How did you feel about her performance there, especially in that beginning part? Because it is clearly like setting up toward the vampire reveal and everything. So she's playing it very sweet. I don't know. How'd you feel about that performance in the first
act?
She's
really good. It feels like setup. Those are the scenes I wondered most. Like her performances are the ones I wondered most. Where when they wrote the script and maybe even filmed those scenes, were they thinking that this is going to be a twist, a second act twist? I think ultimately not. I mean, most of the movie, she's a vampire. It's all over the posters. You just know that she is. So I do think the actress, Alicia Weir, is kind of giving this like underneath, like behind the eyes, sinister attitude toward it. I thought she was really good.
Oh, yeah, she was great. I thought she did a really good job. And I don't think it's interesting because I don't really think that it was filmed with that kind of second act twist in mind. I don't think that the first act was really written for a twist change up. And by that, I mean, because specifically like her first scene with Joey, the first thing she says is she's asking personal questions. She's acting very like scared and everything. And that that's something that I didn't connect. Like with vampire lore, I didn't connect the whole glamour thing, the whole like mind control sort of power that they have. I didn't connect that until it was referenced like later in the movie. And I was just like, damn, that's some pretty solid just like groundwork for that, because it's not too on the nose. It's not too much like, yeah, she's, you know, she's it's more like she's getting into their minds
Yes.
In a way that would be a kidnapped
seductive
person.
And I don't mean for that to sound gross.
Right.
But they're definitely like, at least Joey wants to be a caretaker.
Yeah. Like I didn't, with the first scene with her and Joey where she asks her name and then asks her son's name and asks if she has a son and everything. Like going into the movie, knowing that it's a vampire movie, I did not connect that with vampire stuff. I connected that with young girl is being held captive by a group of people. She wants to humanize herself. She wants to forge a connection and like even to the point where she is guessing her son's name.
So, stick a pin in this for spoilers.
Yes, but yes.
I had thoughts during this scene that we'll save. So Act Two begins, and it kind of goes, I was going to say off the rails, but that's not true, because that kind of that has a negative connotation. No. Just all hell breaks loose.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. She is out of the cage, and people start dying. What do you think of the gore effects?
Oh my god! Like it's so. This is kind of interesting, and this is going to be an interesting kind of thought exercise. But had this movie been made 2 years ago, 3 years ago, even, like this could have been. I could see them making this movie during when shit was hitting the fan with the pandemic, and because it's an enclosed space, an ensemble. But I don't know that they would have been able to get as visceral as they did with the gore in those confines, with those restrictions.
Yeah.
The level of horror and that kind of, I don't know if I would even call it like a signature Radio Silence bloodbath sort of thing, but like just the way that blood is utilized in this is gross and awesome. And it's so much fun. Like
it is,
it's obviously like they know what they're doing with horror.
Yeah.
They know they're, at this point, they are very, very well versed at that. But what I love about this is that the common kind of criticism for modern horror or horror in general is like, oh, there's too many jump scares. They made me jump scare, and I didn't think that. I thought that was cheap.
Right? How cheap is a jump scare?
Yeah. What I love is that the jump scares in this is just gore. It's just gore stuff, and like it's. It is so freaking effective.
A couple times. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, they definitely have a signature move in their two kind of like original movies, their original ideas. And it's kind of an allusion almost to Ready or Not in some of the things. I think we're talking about the same things, but they're so great. They're so great.
Oh yeah. It's oh my god. It's so good. It's so much fun. So go ahead.
Yeah, do we want to do kind of final thoughts on maybe the third act, the movie as a whole, and our recommendations, and then kind of go spoilery?
Absolutely, because there's some stuff I want to talk about in the spoilers for sure. So I can just kind of give an overall thing. I don't know the ins and outs of the writing of this movie because it is written by Stephen Shields and Guy Busick. Guy Busick is one half of the writing team that did Scream and Scream 6. The other guy is James Vanderbilt, I think.
Yes.
Did they also do Ready or Not together? Do you know?
I believe that they did. Yes, they did.
Okay. So it's interesting that like one of them is the credited writer for Scream 7.
Vanderbilt is still on Scream 7. Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting to me too. That's for another podcast. But,
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. But then, you know, they when you have like rewrites and stuff happen, that like the credited writers for a thing can be so kind of crazy.
Oh, 100%.
And I'm sure Scream 7 will be based on a script by James Vanderbilt or whatever, you know, it'll be.
Yeah, the actual credits for Scream 7 are James Vanderbilt's story by credit and Guy Busick written by credit. So,
okay.
Yeah. Gotcha. So that's interesting. But anyway, all that's to say that these two guys are like a writing team. in their own right. And I wonder, James Vanderbilt is a credited producer on Abigail, but I'm just kind of curious.
Zodiac,
interesting.
Picture Zodiac, yeah.
Wow, interesting. But anyway, to get back to the wrapping up of the non-spoiler review, I loved this movie, man. It's Radio Silence is a force to be reckoned with horror, it's crazy because my movie watching year this year has been all over the place crazy. I'm loving it. Like, this year has been awesome. Because I've been doing like two reviews a week on the podcast, and so I'm seeing a lot of like mainstream releases, a lot of the big releases and everything. But even I felt like a little bit not fatigued per se with horror, but more like I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, in OV422, I did a secondary review of Upgraded, specifically because I've been doing a lot of horror reviews, like Imaginary, You'll Never Find Me, Monolith, sort of, a bunch of stuff. So it's good that even with me wanting to take somewhat of a break from horror, like a self-imposed break, that this can come out and just completely just pull me in and make me not even think about the other movies.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So I loved it. I ended up rating it 4 stars on Letterboxd, so it will be in contention for my top 10, but my top 10 is usually 4.5 stars, so we'll see what how that shakes out with the rest of the year. But man, I love it. I want Radio Silence to continue making interesting, crazy, fun horror movies like this, and we can talk about the bigger implications of this movie and the creation of it in spoilers. But for now, I really loved this movie. I thought it was great.
Yeah, I agree with you. I kind of had a very similar experience. I don't feel the fatigue as much. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely I am up for a horror buffet. And so I tend to, like, when I watch so much garbage horror that when you get one that's genuinely good, it's really a treat. And this is one of the genuinely good ones. It was made with care and intention and purpose. I think the directors, the writers, I think the entire cast was excited about making something original. Mm-hmm. With an asterisk on original.
Right.
And something interesting and something fun. It's made with care and it's well acted and well performed. I talked earlier about the two things that really stuck out to me were the ensemble, which I thought were pretty effective, and then the vampire lore. And I'm really kind of developing this love affair lately with vampires and vampire lore. Renfield and Last Voyage of the Demeter last year were not great movies, but I really loved the vampire lore and the respect to vampire legend. And yes, I recently watched Bram Stoker's Dracula a couple years ago, Brian De Palma, a couple weeks ago, excuse me. Mm-hmm. And I love it. So I'm kind of like checking off boxes, like, okay, this is a vampire movie. Do they do this? Uh-huh. And they all, I think, kind of interpret the rules in their own way. And I just kind of loved the way this one interpreted those rules and then kind of takes what is kind of silly about vampire lore and fun about vampire lore and really has a lot of fun with it in this, to quote Scream, a third act bloodbath.
Yes.
It was just so much fun and well made. I agree that I don't know that I'll see it on my top 10 list because I don't think the movie is transcendent. It's not better than some of the other very good horror movies you see in a year. But it's a good time, and I'll definitely watch it again before the end of the year.
Oh, absolutely. This is going to be a great, like, throw it on horror movie when it hits Vudu or even a streaming service.
I think it's a fun double feature with Ready or Not.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, 100%. Oh, yeah. So what did you end up rating it on Letterboxd, did you say?
Four stars.
Yeah. Nice. Mm-hmm. So let's go ahead and go into spoilers for Abigail then. So we are coming to the point where we're going to be doing a spoiler review. So if you want to skip the spoiler section and go to the secondary review, check the show notes. Again, the show notes are at obsessiveviewer.com/OV425. So yeah, we're going to go ahead and go into spoilers for Abigail after this clip from the trailer.
Joey?
Yeah.
I'm sorry about what's gonna happen to you.
What the fuck?
Shit, we gotta get out of here.
I think she knows something.
Guys? Guys?
We kidnapped a fucking vampire. A ballerina vampire.
All right. So spoilers on for Abigail. Mike, there's a bunch of different things that I want to talk about with this.
Yeah.
Where do you want to start?
Yeah. During the press for Scream 6, about a year and a half ago, when everybody was so excited to talk about what's before Scream 6 even came out, they loved to ask Radio Silence, what's next? Are you guys doing Scream 7? Is there a trilogy? And they said, actually, no, our next project is going to be a monster movie for Universal Studios. Mm-hmm. And I remember being excited about that and kind of making predictions. I love the Universal Monsters. And then kind of just filing it away as like, okay, we'll see later what that is. And so after I watched Abigail the other night, as I do most weeks, I texted Matt after the movie and I said, oh, wait, was Abigail the Universal Monster movie that Radio Silence was talking about while they were promoting Scream 6? Because they got away from it a little bit at the end of the movie. So at the end of the movie reveals that Abigail is hundreds of years old and she is the daughter of a vampire. The movie actually began as a story about Dracula's daughter.
Yes. It was going to be a riff on Dracula's daughter, like the original movie.
Dracula's daughter. Yeah. And so that it began explicitly as Dracula's daughter. Mm-hmm. And I think after a while they moved away from it. This isn't speculation. This is I've seen this on Bloody Disgusting. I've seen it on a couple of other websites. Mm-hmm. It is Dracula. I think we can kind of
they keep it ambiguous
as if it is Dracula.
They have they have that one line where he's played by Matthew Good. Like that kind of seems like an interesting casting choice. Not that he's like a huge actor or anything, but like for someone who is in the end of the movie with limited screen time, it just seems like that's an interesting choice. I guess I don't know, but he's like, he says the line like, I've gone by many names, like kind of interesting. What's really fascinating to me, or maybe not fascinating but more interesting and makes me happy, is that this is very smartly done. The Universal Monsters connection to it is very smartly done, specifically because it's not like a backdoor pilot for something. It's not like it's not like an interconnected multiverse or shared universe thing, because I don't know if that's something that they were conscious of while writing it, or if that's something that I don't know if Universal was like, hey, we should do the Universal Monsters thing, because we had success with the Invisible Man. And like, what I really appreciate about this is that it's so open-ended. It's so, like, it can go that route if they decide to do something like that, but it's not the overall contained movie is not married to that at all. And I think that's the smartest
way. And with a $10 million opening
weekend. Yeah, yeah. Which is a shame, because I would love for them to do like the Universal Monsters proper, like do like actual, like a whole thing. But I don't know if that'll ever happen. But anyway, That's something I found really interesting and really enjoyable about that, is that it isn't, it is its own self-contained thing. Mm-hmm. The other thing, have you seen what I think Matt or Tyler, whichever one, they, I'm on a first name basis with them.
Yeah, your buddies Matt and Ty.
Yep. Yeah. one of them said that, I guess someone asked if this is in the Ready or Not universe, and they said, yeah, it is. Have you seen that?
Oh, it sounds familiar. Mm.
Well, apparently there's a, in the background in one scene, there is a painting of Henry Searsney. I can't remember how you pronounce his last name. And it's like one of the directors said that it would be like his great, 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 great grandfather or something. But yeah, it's saying that they're in the same universe. Like it's that. That's the thing. So I think that's interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah. Plus we're getting a Ready or Not 2.
That's fun, I guess.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. So that, how do you feel about that? Just as an aside before we continue with the review.
I don't know. I trust them cause I like them a lot, but, mm-hmm. but file that under movies I didn't think needed a sequel.
Same. So
we talked in our non-spoiler section about that early scene where Joey and Abigail are kind of talking in the room. That was when was there a point where you started to suspect that she was like hundreds of years old?
No, that's actually interesting because I didn't even really consider that. I think because she played that like innocent child so well, it just didn't even register with me. Like I didn't even think about that.
Because she's playing it so well, right? Yep. But also like, you know, to be such a perfect solo ballerina like that, she's just had a couple hundred years to practice doing that, which I think is so interesting.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, you know, when they go into the mansion and you see the statues and it's her with the, or it's a young girl with the taller shrouded man.
Yeah.
I thought that she was going to be the vampire and the dad was like her familiar or something like
that. Oh, interesting.
And so, and the idea was he arranged with Giancarlo Esposito's character to have them come here to feed, which ends up kind of being what it is. But I guess I didn't expect the father to be Dracula, I guess.
Right. Yeah. And I was pretty pleased with that dynamic. I did like how it was kind of revealed that they all had a connection to the crime lord, and like it felt it was very, very like Saw 2 interconnected storylines and stuff. Which that is to say that like there's a subpar version of this movie where we don't get any of the backstory, and that's when we get the backstory. So that's why I appreciate that scene with them, with Joey just kind of like figuring them out just by sight alone and everything. Also, it makes for an interesting mirror to Abigail when she does that to them, when she tells them like, oh, this is like, you were involved in this and I know this about you and everything.
Yes, very good.
So I really like that kind of interconnected stuff between Abigail and Joey.
It is interesting, though, that they gave those backstories and Saw-esque versions why they're there. Because I got the sense that she brings people there all the time just to eat.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is a mass grave in the pool.
We know that she does. So that's cool, and it's well-written. I think that's interesting. Mm-hmm. But also, I don't know, I guess, like, is every group she brings there connected? You know what I mean?
I would think that their deaths
are wronged.
Yeah. If not people who have wronged them, wronged that criminal organization, they're at least people whose death would benefit that criminal organization in some capacity, whether it be competition or what have you.
You're probably right.
Yeah.
You're probably right.
There
was, if there was one scene or one moment or one turn that knocked maybe a half star off, or I did seem critical of, is when Dan Stevens' character turns, he goes full on villain, full on psycho villain. And do you feel like they established that enough? Did you see that coming?
I did. I do think that they established it pretty well, because there were just hints and outright references to him being power hungry, him being wanting to have power in the organization. Like, even at the beginning, I mean, like we said in the non-spoiler, I mean, he's patterned after his wardrobe is patterned after.
Yeah, that's true. He used to be a shithead.
He used to be a piece of shit.
Yeah.
But yeah, and also with the backstory being about him being a corrupt cop who is now working as a professional, like, criminal, like, that's,
yeah,
it's painting it, like, and he also has this energy of, like, take charge and dickheadedness, which I think Dan Stevens does incredibly well in this movie. Like, his performance is fantastic. But did you think when they took Abigail at the beginning that they were setting up him, like, his injury? I thought it was like, oh, this is how they're going to find out she's a vampire, because he got bitten on the hand. But I don't think he was. There was probably something else.
She stabs him with a pencil.
Oh, okay. I missed that. Okay.
Yeah. I kind of said that I saw the Band-Aid there later, and I was like, oh, wait. I'm like, oh, okay. That was a pencil. That was the pencil we saw earlier. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. But they do, there is a bite and a turn. Catherine Newton. And I loved it.
Oh, me too.
I love every moment of the mind control and puppetry. That is like playing with the lore that I was talking about.
Nice.
You know, Abigail talks about you have to practice all the cool stuff that vampires can do or whatever.
I fucking loved that line.
Yeah, yeah.
So good.
That's funny. And that's kind of like, you know, she's 100s of years old, but she's also perpetually a 12-year-old. That's the way a 12-year-old would think of.
Yes.
You know, being a vampire is learning the cool stuff or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's cool that she has that power and you know, is able to, again, seduce, I think, is the vampire
influence
there. Yeah,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. What'd you think of the choreography and everything? Because, like with the ballet stuff, like, I feel like that was not overused at all. Like, this whole movie, top to bottom, is paced incredibly well, and the change-ups in the plot, the different things that happen at different intervals, like, those work so well because it's structured so well. So that's what I think about it. Well, how'd you feel about the choreography and the more crazy violence? And we have a new viewer in the chat. We are in spoilers for Abigail, so go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I loved all of it. I thought her using ballerina kung fu is, again, it all came off as, like, practiced.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's been doing this, not just that she has these super strength powers and can fly and whatever. Yeah. She also has just been doing this for a long time. I also didn't feel like, you know, I think the easy comparison was that it looked like Megan, right? This young girl, evil girl who also does a
dance.
Seductive dance. Yeah. I just even feel gross saying that. But, I mean, that's what Megan was.
Yeah.
It's not, Abigail doesn't rely on that. It's really not that. It's not a ballerina vampire movie.
Right.
You know what I mean? Whereas Megan, like, is what it is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And Abigail, I feel like, is more.
Oh, 100%. And the kind of, we can get kind of in the final act of the movie, that turn with Dan Stevens, what I find interesting is, like, turning things around, having, like, Catherine Newton and Dan Stevens' characters both being, like, kind of alternate villains in a sense. That's so like that's very smartly written because we need that from the movie. But also, also when the main crux of like the emotion of the movie is Joey and her son and her forming this like bond with Abigail, like that's such a narrow, like a small needle to thread in this. And I think they did it incredibly well. She's still violent. Like Abigail is still violent. She's still a threat. She's still scary. But that bond between her and Joey is really strong. And I like that. And in light of like turning like Catherine Newton and Dan Stevens as bigger villains in a sense. Well, I mean, Catherine Newton was controlled by her, so...
Yeah, Catherine Newton, not so much, but you have to have in a vampire movie, it becomes a thing where your main characters are dealing with their friends turning into vampires. I mean, that's part of the lore. That is... that's stock. That's stereotype. You have to do that. You expect it. You want it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
The gore that we were talking about.
Oh my God! Yes, yes.
Is when they're touched by sunlight, instead of like burning or melting, they just explode.
They do the ready or not thing. They just explode.
Yeah,
it's amazing. It's just so awesome. And I feel like I've seen that before. I've seen that in. It's been so long since I've seen True Blood, and I only saw like a season or two. But I feel like that's the type of sunlight thing that happens in that.
Gotcha.
But this was just, like the bloodbath aspect of like literal bloodbath, like just like that's the other thing with Ready or Not in this. It's just like having the final girl being just covered in blood at the end of the movie is just so it's so much fun. It's I don't know. It's really cool. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the escape through the birth canal. It's coming out the other side, reborn.
Yep.
Covered in viscera.
Yep. And I also had vibes of The Descent at the end when she's in the car.
I mean, talk about coming out of birth canal.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Just really, really great stuff. I'm thinking, I can't wait to do like a double feature of this and Ready or Not now.
Yeah. For sure.
So good. Anything else in spoilers for Abigail?
I don't think so.
Nice. Yeah, that is about it. So that is our review of Abigail. That's it for this review. Like this is the
you wanna do rapid fire potpourri?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't have anything, but that's like since we'll be going on to the secondary review here shortly, let's bid adieu to Mike with a rapid fire potpourri section for him to cover us in the blood of his viewing. That's weird.
Okay. Sure. Yeah. So I watched 2004's Eurotrip.
Eurotrip and Road Trip.
Road Trip. Yeah. Yeah.
These were first time viewings for you?
No.
Okay.
Their first time loggings on Letterboxd.
Okay.
I haven't watched them since 2007 or whatever.
Sure.
Right. So my Letterboxd logging goes back to about 2008. And if I haven't watched it since then, I haven't logged it, but like kids movies, there's all kinds of movies that I have seen, I just haven't I guess it looks like a first time, but no, I've seen Road Trip and I've seen Euro Trip, and in fact my review of Euro Trip, which by the way 1.5 stars, which may be too generous, this is the type of movie where at first you're a year too young to see it in theaters, and your friend Ross's older brother won't buy you a ticket to see it. So when you finally rent it on DVD a year later, when you're old enough, it sucks. But then a few years later, you can't remember if it sucked or not. So you buy it and watch it, but it sucks. So you sell it at a yard sale. And then like 10, 15 years later, you see it at a consignment shop for $1 next to Road Trip and say, what the hey, and buy it because you can't remember if it sucked or not. But then you watch it when you're 37 and it sucks. This movie sucks.
Oh, that sucks.
Hot take. Scotty Doesn't Know isn't even a good song.
Okay, that is so interesting, and I agree. There was like an article, like a listicle thing where it was like, or it might have been like a, no, it was an article. It was a published article somewhere that was like, what are the, like, these are the best fake songs in movies.
Movie songs.
And
oh
like,
my God.
And like, when I saw Scotty Doesn't Know on there, it's like, okay, that's not like, I'm not a music snob at all. But no. That's not that, that's more because, you know, Matt Damon is in
Matt
the movie.
Damon. Absolutely.
Like that's, yeah. That it has nothing to do with the artistry of song.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
Road Trip, which I did watch the other night, mm-hmm. has its charms. It's also mm-hmm. stupid, but there's a charm and innocence to it. Euro Trip is egregiously foul,
mm-hmm.
racist, homophobic.
Oh yeah.
It's all, you know, that just was the humor in from 2001 to 2009. Just like calling people the R word and every last any hint of two guys' hands touching is homophobic. I just but not even that. I mean, that stuff is horrible, and that stuff is tough to go back and watch from the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
But just the movie itself is horrible and not funny and not interesting and poorly made and poorly acted. Hated it.
That's rough. I haven't seen it in many years. But that's so interesting with like the humor, like that humor, definitely not aging well at all.
No, so bad.
I wonder, and I was going to say this. I was going to ask this, but I realized that this is not the case. But like my thought was, was that humor just of the time, or was it of the time of us being teenagers?
Well, that's a great and fair question. Mm-hmm. And not to let us off the hook, because, you know,
mm-hmm.
but I do think it was of the time. I mean, there are full episodes of Friends
mm-hmm.
where the B story joke is a homophobic bit.
Yep.
Right? Like, are these characters gay? Huh? We don't want people to think we're gay.
Right.
That really was the humor. I mean, people just called people the R word mm-hmm. all the time.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It was
it's wild.
It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. Yep.
Yep.
Yeah.
There's I think that there's we're getting to some real scumbag territory here, mm-hmm. and I apologize if any of my students listen to this. but I think that there is an avenue for the type of movie that Eurotrip and Road Trip comes from.
Mm-hmm.
That type of like guys trying to get some on a trip and see nudity.
Yeah.
That's not offensive to me.
No.
And I think as immature and like, I'm not a horny teenager anymore, right. Thank God.
Mm-hmm.
That still feels nostalgic and, again, forgive me, timeless to me. Like, that's okay. I forgive that, as objectifying as that may be in movies. I get that perspective where the jokes are at the expense of whatever marginalized group.
Yeah.
That just does not age well.
No, not
There's
at
no
all.
There's no defense for that.
Yeah. I would be curious to go back and watch some of these movies from that era. Like, the one that jumps to mind for me is not a good movie, but it's something that I kind of latched onto and I enjoyed, was Sex Drive.
That's a great one.
Nice, nice.
That's
I'm
a
glad,
great one. Yeah,
I'm glad to
I watched
hear that.
It over the summer.
Nice.
2009, so that's kind of at the tail end of that genre. And I also think it's speaking to that genre, not it's a little like Scream in that not that it's like a satire of the genre,
right.
but it is fully aware of what it's doing. And I can't think of a movie like that that happened after.
I can't either, but I do just reminds
like
me.
Like shortly after that, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, you're good.
I've been really thinking about these types of movies a lot lately. Shortly after that, The Hangover came up.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that type of R-rated comedy became for adults in their 20s and 30s instead.
Like, even before The Hangover, you had like old school, like the frat pack. Like older sex comedies, comedies like that.
Right.
So it's interesting. The thing I was going to mention about Sex Drive is just, I remember like in the credits, like they had like outtakes and stuff. And I remember the, Amish character played by Seth Green is like talking to the guys from Fall Out Boy, and then like the reference to Pete Wentz's dick leak photo leak is great, because like you can I feel like you can tell like it's so like improvised, unexpected. Yep. It's just so great.
I love that.
That stands out to me. But anything else for this mid episode potpourri?
I don't think so. That'll do it. Thanks for having me back.
Of course. So if you could just let people know where they can find you online before we bid adieu to you and go to our secondary review.
Yeah. So I am As Good As It Gets Music, as.good.it.gets.music on Instagram. That's kind of the place I check the most. You can just get a hold of me through Matt. Or kind of comment on these episodes.
Yes. And there is a link to your As Good As It Gets link tree in the show notes of the episode.
Thank you.
Yeah. So that'll do it for our featured review. I'm not sure which one.
We're workshopping it.
That's it for the feature review. Stay tuned on the podcast for me to go on to the secondary review, where I am going to be reviewing Sasquatch Sunset and not Rebel Moon Part 2, like I said last week, because
sounds intriguing.
It's very intriguing. Like, I'll get into that at the rest of the episode. But anyway, thank you to those who watched the live stream. I've seen people come and go, so appreciate it and everything. I'm going to close down the live stream now, and then I'm going to go ahead and go into the secondary review of the evening. Mike, always a pleasure. Obviously, can't wait to talk to you again.
For sure.
Yeah.
See you guys.
Okay, and before we get to our secondary review, I want to take a quick moment to remind you that if you like the show, please take a moment to follow us on social media and subscribe to and rate the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube Music, or whatever your preferred podcast app is. And don't forget to subscribe to the Obsessive Viewer Podcast's YouTube channel as well, where I'm posting more and more videos and live streams of podcasts. And now, back to the show.
They tell me I view obsessively.
And now we're here with the secondary review. I am here flying solo for a secondary review of Sasquatch Sunset, which is currently in theaters. I'm going to do a non-spoiler review because I frankly don't know how long this review is going to be, because I don't have much to say about it, but we'll soldier on through here. A quick note about this is that I originally planned to review Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scar Giver, the second part of Zack Snyder's Dumb Shit Seven Samurai. But I decided to go with Sasquatch Sunset because it's a unique movie, and I feel like it was potentially going to be a better choice than Rebel Moon Part 2. Having said that, I rated this 1.5 stars, so I don't know if it was much better than Rebel Moon Part 2 would have been for me. I haven't watched Rebel Moon Part 2. I don't know if I'm going to, but I probably will eventually, just to have something to talk about from the world of fiction and science on Anthology, that section there. So I don't know. But anyway, let's go into my secondary review. Here's my review of Sasquatch Sunset. The premise, according to IMDb, is a year in the life of a unique family. It captures the daily life of the Sasquatch with a level of detail and rigor that is simply unforgettable. Directors for this movie were Nathan Zellner and David Zellner. Writer was David Zellner, and and the cast includes Riley Keough, Jesse Eisenberg, Christoph Zajac, Denek, and Nathan Zellner. Nathan and David Zellner, I believe, worked with Nathan Fielder and Emma Stone on The Curse, which is a show that I haven't watched yet, but I am very interested in seeing because I really like Nathan Fielder for sure. But I don't know how closely they worked on that or if I'm even getting that right. Yes, they were. No. I don't have that right. No. Okay. I don't know where they work from. David Zellner. But anyway, this movie. Oh, they previously did Kumiko the Treasure Hunter, which is a movie that I never saw. I don't know. I thought that they, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. I'm sorry, you guys. but this movie, yes, they did direct at least one episode of The Curse. Three episodes of The Curse were directed by at least one of the Zellners. So, okay, let's stop spinning my wheels here. And let's get into this movie. So it is a unique movie in that it is completely from the perspective of Sasquatches. It's a family of five or four. I don't know the cast. I just read four people. They don't have names since they're Sasquatches. They only speak in grunts and body language. And that is where I find this to be an interesting movie, because it is capable of eliciting some emotion out of you, because you have this strictly body language, nonverbal storytelling, which I think is really interestingly done in this movie. Everything else, the concept of it is interesting. That's what I'm trying to say, is that the concept of it is interesting. Everything else around it, the execution of it, is far less interesting. I will say that the movie opens with just like clips of them. The movie is centered, like the narrative structure of it is 1 year with this family of Sasquatch. It's segmented by season. So I think it starts spring, summer, fall, winter. And it's just them going along, trying, like, I don't know if it's technically migrating, but like they're moving, they're leaving, they're finding different things in the woods, and there is a level of thrilling aspects to it that make it a little bit more digestible than it would if it was just a straight like comedy, because it is kind of marketed as a comedy. It is like this weird comedy where, like, one of the opening scenes, what I was getting at was that there's a bunch of clips of this family, the various members of this family. And it's like this kind of documentarian approach, this documentary style approach, where we're in the camera and we're watching them just exist in the woods, in wilderness. And then that is punctuated like after the title screen or the title card of the movie, it's punctuated by just like the just two of them just going at it, having just very aggressive sex and grunting aggressively. I forgot to play a clip from the trailer in the recording, but let me actually go ahead and play a clip from the trailer. So here's a clip from the trailer for Sasquatch Sunset, and then I'll talk about it. So that's a clip from the trailer. Like I said, there's no dialogue or anything, so it's just ambience and noise and then sex noises. It's funny because in that moment when I was watching the movie, I like had the thought that like the joke that I made was it's interesting that I was going to review Rebel Moon Part 2, but instead chose to review Sasquatch Sunset. It's interesting because one of the opening scenes of Sasquatch Sunset shows what Zack Snyder did to Seven Samurai when making Rebel Moon. That was terrible. But anyway, this movie just didn't work for me because it's presented as somewhat of a comedy because of those like gross out humor moments. There's a moment later in the movie involving very like celebratory bodily fluids. That's what I'll say. It's not a sexual thing. It's just celebratory bodily fluids. And it's weird. It didn't land for me as a piece of comedy at all. But I will say that, again, going back to the kind of emotional aspect of it, there is a certain level of emotional resonance that I found in the movie. And I'm not above, like, even though I rated it 1.5 stars, I'm not above like noticing those things. Like, the storytelling in this movie is very unique and works in a couple of places. There are some very big like wilderness adventure sort of moments. Like, there's one at least in particular, but there's one sequence that I feel like is very smartly done. It's a kind of tragic moment in the movie, in as tragic a moment as can be in this, but the way it's set up and the way that it's paid off is like a shock to the system. It's like a jump scare. It's very effective. And like, there's a bit of emotional resonance in that moment. And what I'm disappointed by and upset about with this movie is that is so few and far between. There is not a lot of the family dynamic. Like, it's set up like a punchline for a Farrelly Brothers movie with like gratuitous sex and weird bodily fluids. At times it feels like it is a Farrelly Brothers movie. And then in other times, at other points, it feels like it is like, it's them riffing on the Dawn of Man sequence in 2001, A Space Odyssey. And like those two dynamics, those two sorts of ideas do not work together at all. So I think the overall picture of the movie is just not to my liking. It doesn't work for me. It barely worked for me like at all. I will say that the makeup effects, the design of the creatures in this movie was pretty good. Like, it's very good. It's like probably the best thing about the movie. I don't know how much more I can say about it. It's not that good. It is in theaters, but I would say, you know, this, it famously or infamously had a lot of walkouts with when it was at, I think, South by Southwest. And I like, when you have a movie like that, that is so like infamous for like, oh, people walked out of it at the film festival. Like, oh, it must be provocative. It must be like really interesting. Like, this is the like exception to the rule for that. Because this isn't an interesting, provocative movie. It's just like, as I was watching it, I really, it was at Sundance. It premiered at Sundance. It received many walkouts during its world premiere at the Sundance Film Festival in January of this year. And like, when I hear that, I think, oh, it must be provocative. It must be interesting. It must have something worthwhile to say. But like, within probably 5 to 10 minutes of this movie, I just thought, oh, I get it. Like, I totally get it. I probably wouldn't have walked out, but I will say this was like the longest 88-minute movie I've ever seen. And famously, I've watched The Dark Tower a couple of times. So like, that's not saying that lightly. Like, this is an 88-minute movie. And like, I felt every miserable second of it because, like I said, those moments where we had some kind of emotional resonance or some kind of excitement go on with it, that it is only like two moments in the entire movie, and the rest is filled with, like, it's not even like the rest of it is filled with comedic moments or filled with things that would be construed as comedy or be interpreted as comedy that just fell flat for me. It's like they filled 88 minutes with two like emotional, like family moments, and like a handful of plot advancing moments, and then like comedy bits spread throughout the movie. And even with that, like, concoction of different styles, different things, it's still like that cumulatively would only fill like maybe 60 minutes, and the rest is just boring nothingness. And it just didn't work for me. So that is my non-spoiler review for Sasquatch Sunset. Once again, I rated it 1.5 stars. I really don't know if I would have liked Rebel Moon Part 2 more or less than this. I did rate Rebel Moon Part 1 like 0.5 star. That's the other thing. That's the other reason why I chose to review Sasquatch Sunset instead of Rebel Moon Part 2, is because Rebel Moon Part 1 came out like 5 months ago. I reviewed it like 4 months ago on the podcast and on the website, I think. I don't remember anything about it. Like, I really do not remember. I don't remember much of anything about it, except that I really didn't like it. And I didn't, oh, I did review it on the website last year in December. And I just don't remember any of the characters or anything. That's insane. It's insane to me. So that's one of the other reasons why I didn't review Rebel Moon Part 2. I might watch it and throw an immediate reaction on Patreon at some point, but it is what it is. Like, Sasquatch Sunset was not to my liking either, so I would not recommend seeing it in the theater. I don't know. So anyway, that's my secondary review. Let's wrap up the episode. That's it for this week's episode of The Obsessive Viewer. As always, thank you so much for listening, and make sure to follow the show on social media and subscribe to the podcast on your preferred podcast app. Also check out Obsessive Viewer Podcast's other shows, Tower Junkies, a Stephen King podcast hosted by Tiny and myself, and Anthology, the Twilight Zone and classic sci-fi podcast hosted by me, which is starting season 4 this week. This Friday, I will have the first episode of season 4 of the Twilight Zone reviewed on Anthology. Very excited about that. Next week on Obsessive Viewer, I'm going to be reviewing Shogun, the miniseries. So stay tuned for that, and thank you for listening. And now, enjoy this short clip from a recent Patreon-exclusive episode. For the full episode and more Patreon-exclusive content, sign up at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. I kind of came away from this movie thinking that I, as a 37-year-old man, could not really connect with the movie the way that it would have definitely connected with me as a 15 or 16 year old kid. And I say that from experience, because I loved Clerks for what Clerks was when I saw it when I was that age. Clerks is very much a day in the life story about people that are just overthinking things and over articulating things, while it's that juxtaposition of characters being overly articulate about subjects that ultimately don't really matter, or aren't as serious in the mainstream, in the main scheme of things, even. But they speak to it as if it is the most important thing in the world. That is something that I gravitated toward when I was in my late teens, early 20s, because that, I think that that was an interesting road in. Like, I'm talking specifically about Clerks. It was an interesting road into.
Thank you for listening to the Obsessive Viewer podcast. This episode was produced and edited by me, Matt Hurt. If you have feedback, thoughts on our episodes, or just want to connect, you can email me at matt@obsessiveviewer.com. For more information on this show, including a full archive of our episodes and show notes, visit obsessiveviewer.com. And if you enjoyed the show, please give us a follow on social media and subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice so you never miss an episode. Also, consider rating and reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Audible to help increase our visibility and grow our community. If you want to support the show and get early access to new episodes, as well as a steady stream of exclusive episodes, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. For information on more podcasts presented by obsessiveviewer.com, visit obsessiveviewer.com/podcasts. Our theme song is A Little Mad Sometimes by As Good As It Gets. For more of their music, check them out on Spotify and at asgoodasitgetsmusic.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.
See this episode's show notes for our unique promo code to get up to 2 months of free podcasting service with Libsyn when you sign up for a new account. Get your show on Apple and Spotify. Get helpful stats and all the support you need to sound your very best.